If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
So, Elliot Ikile, welcome to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Jerry Pimes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm a little bit uncomfortable in a good way.
What's a good way of being uncomfortable?
Oh, you don't want to be too stuck into a rut sort of system. And if someone's peering into your soul a little bit, I think that can be a good thing, even if it's a little bit uncomfortable.
Well, I don't know about peering into your soul, but I'm very, very interested in you. And I've been very struck by what I've come across so far about you. But for the listeners that don't know you, why don't you just share with the listeners just a bit about what your day is like? What have you been doing? How does your day or your week map out? What do you do in life? And then how does it kind of map out?
Well, I suppose currently, and this is probably going back for the last couple of years, I have my day job, which I do enjoy, and it's getting in amongst the tradies and the systems in there. Can't say too much about it, but let's just say I help build them to be a lot more likely to go home at night. So I do love that, and I get to hear stories. I get to hear struggles of what's going on the construction sites, sewer lines, stormwater drains, all the deeper areas of life that we don't know too much about. After that point, I usually quickly get home and hug the kids. I always like doing a little bit of that. And after seeing wifey, then I engage in some of my other things, which is things like behind the scenes activism, I suppose you'd say. I was a bit more public, and it looks like I might be going back into the public spotlight a little bit, but it's been quite nice to have a little break where I'm behind the scenes rather than in front of the scenes. But it looks like I'm going to get back into the spotlight again soon.
Yeah. So the work you're doing at the moment in your day job, can you not say too much about it? Did I pick that up right?
It's not that it's secret or anything, but rather that that whole word cancel, I have had far left extremists come after me, and they've won a battle before, and it did leave scars. It definitely hurt. It didn't hurt me so much, but it hurt my family a great deal. And then that in turn did hurt me a lot. So I've always been a little bit more careful about announcing where I work, but I absolutely love talking about my job, just perhaps not the details of it. About the details of the identifier of it anyway.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely understandable. And that throws us right into some of the risks that people face who speak out against whatever you might call the mainstream narrative or the far left narrative or whatever words we might use. So explain to the listeners a little bit about your background, like how come you're speaking out? Because I believe you're referring to the Hobson's Pledge activities you're involved in. Is that what you meant when you said, I think I'm starting to be a bit more out there again? Is that?
Yep. Yes. yeah, that's right. I'm not sure where to start from here, but I'll start from where I think it would probably be pertinent, which is I grew up as one of hundreds of thousands of Pacifica people, which is that we support Labour, we're very progressive, we obey the Labour desires, and so therefore we are quite to the left. I wouldn't say far, but definitely moderately to the left at least. And in that, we have a weird dichotomy, which is Pacifica as a people group generally are on one side, they are very much Labour adherents. So they are conservative by nature, but by the ideological positioning of who they are obedient to, they are very progressive. So it's not that they're progressive innately, it's that they obey those who are the political party of their allegiance, and they are progressive. So I believed in things such as the white man was negative for Māori and for Pacifica throughout the last couple of centuries, that the white person was racist and inherently racist, not just in New Zealand, but in different environments, things that the family system could be any family system is absolutely fine. There were other progressive elements that I held on to until I started doing heavy duty youth work and not social work, but community work. In that, I came across a couple of cases which were quite brutal, a couple of suicide slavery cases, and that broke me, went down into a hole. When I came back up, I thought, we're not winning. I'll win a few cases here and there, but we're not winning overall. So I thought about it, I researched, I spoke to heaps of the old school legend frontliners, and what it came out to be was that when we look at youth and young people who grow up to be killers, rapists, abusers themselves, struggling, poor, all of the negative elements, what you find is not white man badism. You don't find even, often there is low education, but not always. What you find is that these are children who are being raised in a broken home. The broken home from 0 to 3, 3 to 16, the growing up structure of it. That is the core pattern with that. And so when I did that, I was like, well, okay, well, that's shocking. Yeah, bad, but it felt good to find a pattern. All right, where's this coming from? Where did it come from? Because if you look at Maori families, for example, they were strong for decades, decades and decades. Urban migration may have lowered it a little bit, but Maori families were still really strong. It wasn't until the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, that we started to see the family structure tremble and then just break after that. The only policy that is of reasonable determination to have caused such a decline is the DPB, which came out in 73, 74. I assume it was well-meaning, but the outcome of that was that it subsidized single parenthood. And when you have the broken home and you have the single parenthood and it's 85% mothers, as of the last decent statistics, we have that it's 85% mum-led homes, solo homes. What we found is that a huge generation from that came out. And one stat that I do bring up a bit, because it's an excellent stat from Lindsay Mitchell, and it was that in the 70s, if you were born as a Māori, you had an 80% chance of being born into a married mum and dad home or a public and contractual agreement to be joined, that style of home. As of right now, or as of a few years ago, that stands at 20%. So in the late 70s or during the 70s, if you're born Māori, you had a 80% chance of being born into a married mum and dad home, which is awesome. The scientific literature is really clear about that. It's great. But when the DPP came in, that solo parenthood went up, and at the same time, we saw the social stats just slide down for Māori to the point where now you've got an 80% chance of being born into a non-married home, and that just causes more chaos in our environment. Anyway, I went through that, spent 2 years coming out of what I call the labor plantation, but when I was out of it, I was very much steadfastly opposed to labor. In fact, I'm still disgusted by what they've done to Pacifica people, because Pacifica people, unlike Māori, unlike Pākehā or Caucasians or whatever word we want to use, Pacifica do tend to move en masse in certain ways. And one of the ways has been the Dawn Raids and the Labour Party allegiance. And that's why, for example, if I really want to poke and rock the boat a bit, I go to Pacifica groups and I say, great, Dawn Raids, evil, cool. All right, if you believe that, no worries. Tell me, who started the Dawn Raids? And always, almost always, it's, National Party, National Party. And I have to remind them, no, the Labour Party started the Dawn Raids that you hate so much. And one of the large reasons to why you have now obeyed Labour is because of the Dawn Raids that Labour actually started. And so it really is, for some of those people, and it really is a bit of a Matrix moment, you know, coming out of the pod and realize, oh, that's orcs. So that led me on a path where I became a conservative, a true conservative. No longer was I on the Labour plantation. Now I was out and free and joined up. So I joined up with a political party, fought heavily for them for years, loved it, enjoyed it. There was pain and struggle. There were losses and wins, but it felt good to be standing on a platform of truth, and for myself, for the Christianity that I began when I was 25 years old. And so I was happy to be in a place where, even with the struggles, the losses, the attacks, the constant attacks, it felt really good to be in a place where this is right. Where I'm standing is right. And that's why it's so easy to defend, and why it's so easy to take on the attacks that the left have engaged in for years.
Thank you for that. Taking us through a really big societal situation, as well as your own personal situation. What you just described is, it's one of the most biggest social changes you could imagine. I mean, to go from 80% kind of family-based to 80% single-parent-based in literally just 10 years, or starting at, you know, just in a very short time, that surely the sociologists and the universities and the academics have been highlighting this massive change. Have they been writing about this change?
No, of course not. Of course they haven't. Instead, a lot of the sociologists and the academics basically blame white men. It's again go back to, oh, the days of colonization and, you know, all of this stuff, which I used to totally believe. In fact, there's an essay which I've kept from when I was at seventh form, and I was so embarrassed now to read it back. I wrote in there so many times institutional racism. I wrote that all throughout the essay, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I go cringe now. I will have to point out that it's not so much solo parent homes. So in the late 70s, early 80s, when the family started to decline, it was 80% were married mum and dad's homes. But when I say 20%, some of that is solo parent homes, and some of that is just unmarried, boyfriend, girlfriend getting together. And of course, after Helen Clark's union bill, that caused a lot of problems as well, because suddenly you had cohabitation, which I believe has got about a 5-year lifespan. And that's where you get, so it does, you're right, it does become quite often solo parent homes, but I just wanted to bring that slight difference out. And that number's from about 2015-16, so it's very likely worse now. I get really angry at the fact that academics do not want to sit up and take on these factual areas. And when you look at the factual areas, you only have to look at the big three longitudinal studies, you know, the Pearson, the Dunedin, the UK, and the US studies, those massive long studies. Those are beautiful, clear data. But even when I'm reading one of them, I'm not sure which one it was, but one of them showed how the breakdown family unit did come out with negative social outcomes. But when I read on one of the researchers' reports, one of the researchers who they bring on to the report, their take on it, they put their interpretation. Their interpretation was that there are just different families now, each with a wealth and well-being attached to it. All of the lovely academic words that came out now. And it beggared belief. I was thinking, this is exactly the type of problem that you have now in academia, which is opinion and their desire to be believed what they want to be believed now overcomes the empirical evidence itself. So no longer is empirical evidence useful for your average academic. They have to put on their conclusion for it, and especially when that conclusion is in blatant disregard of the evidence in front of their eyes.
I don't know if you've come across the writings of Matthias Desmet or the work of Matthias Desmet. He's the guy that started speaking out about mass formation. Did you hear about this? He's a psychologist in Belgium.
Belgium, yes. Yep, great one. And his theories pan out.
But before he did anything around COVID, and this tells you something about the guy and how critical he could think, there he is, an academic. He's a lecturer in psychology. And he did a study on the accuracy of peer-reviewed academic articles across the board. And do you know that he found that 80% of those academic peer-reviewed, respectable, and reputable articles were wrong? Can you believe that? The whole the whole edifice of academia that speaks so highly of itself, it was 80% false. That means it was 20% true. Now, that's not a great system, is it? But what you're talking about, Elliot, is so interesting because you're looking at it, I think, from someone that was, from what I've read, you were deeply involved in youth and community work and sometimes working with the real damaged end of that. Am I right about that? Have I read your story right? Yeah.
That would be good.
Yeah. And so you looked at this and you looked at this with your feet on the ground, with a solid place in your heart as to, you know, where you stood. And you looked at this information, you said, hold on a sec. This is a massive shift. And this is a direct causal link between family and government and politics, all interfacing in some quite nefarious way, actually, destructive way, either accidentally or whatever. And you just saw what was going on. You looked at the information and you went to the hard facts. I find it incredible that today there is so much deceit and so much lying and so much interpretation of simple factual information. So, for example, when the whole COVID thing came on, I spent 10 minutes after about 6 months of wearing the mask and drinking the Kool-Aid. I thought, hold on a sec, what is the what's the all-cause mortality death figures? I was in England at the time, and I looked around Europe, America, and they had quite up-to-date figures. Do you know, there wasn't a blip in the bloody figures. There was no increase in all-cause mortality. That's really all you had to look at to know that there was no pandemic. From that moment on, I realized there was no pandemic. It's the same with climate change. All you have to look at is you go to the ice core samples that go back to Middle Ages, the medieval times, the Roman times. You go back further, and what you find is we're not heating up at all. There have been far hotter periods in the history. This whole climate warming and disaster fear mongering is just a complete inaccuracy. And it's so factual. And here you are saying, well, you know, actually, this is a direct shift in the structure of the family of Maori and Pacifica people. And you want to address that. And the academics are not. It's just, it takes my breath away. I've had a long rant. It's supposed to be about you tonight, but you got me going.
I'm sitting back and going, oh, amen, amen, preach, preach.
Oh, good on you, fella. Well, look, I jumped into a little bit of your background. I want to take this conversation a little bit more into who you are. We've talked a lot about just now about society and your engagement with that is, well, good on you. I mean, I'm so glad that there are people out like you out there, Elliot, fighting for what you're fighting. And God bless you for that, because, you know, it takes courage to speak out. And you speak out so clearly. The Hobson's Pledge. Look, I want to say to the viewers, if you want to find out about this wonderful man's views and thoughts, go to Dewey de Boer's episode just in a couple of months, last March, I think it was in March, on RCR Radio, where you were interviewed. And it's a great interview. And the two of you, you talk about such important stuff. And I just want to really encourage the listeners to learn about that side of you from that program. And I often do this. And I then say, well, I'd like to know a bit more about the person. Who is Elliot Ikile? If you were to talk in the third person about you, what sort of guy is he?
Actually, I do know of some elements of my reputation. It's intense. Intense would be a big one. So in terms of how people view me, I am aware that I can be intense and very direct, lacking sensitivity, lacking nuance. That's at least in that public sphere.
What if you What if you were to describe yourself in the third person? How would you describe yourself?
Elliot is intelligent. and he desires to be more sensitive, but he's not. He's quite soft-hearted, but he has an extremely strong outer shell, very strong. It's very difficult to get behind his walls, but he does have a care for all people, including those who hate him, actually. In terms of what he'd rather be doing, he'd rather actually be gaming and going off to different food places and going off to different countries with his family. But for better or worse, he is built with an innate desire to fight injustice and to serve his people. And he's ready to die for his cause, but he desperately does not want to die for it. However, he does think that at some point he may have to give his life to, well, he may have to sacrifice his life so that things such as all people can be together. He hates what's happened to the nation that he grew up in. He believes in absolute that all people should be treated by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. He is aware of the pain that gets put onto those he loves because the left do come after. And to be fair, some on the far right also do come after him for holding certain views and for, well, not for holding certain views, but for him putting his face up into the above the parapet to take on those darker times. He'll die for the cause, but he really doesn't want to. He'd much rather be playing video games, hugging his family, going off to family dues, going off to travel, and just being at church singing songs. That's what he'd much rather do, actually. But the way he sees it is that there's not many other people, and because of whatever God's put in him, he feels that he has to stand up, even at the sacrifice of his own life, so that the world can be a better place. And it needs to be, because it's growing darker for every day that we're here.
Wow.
Oh, never done that before.
Wow, yeah, how are you doing after? That was amazing.
Oh, geez, that went a little bit deep. Sheesh.
That was beautiful. Yeah, but take a breath and just let yourself kind of relax. You know, wow. You're doing great.
Yeah.
I want you to know that I'm not interested in cracking through your shell either. I'm not interested in that. I want you to know that protective, strong shell is part of how God made you, in my opinion. And that serves you really well. If you're out there, man, you're going to need that strong shell. You know, my life has been spent kind of in a therapy room, very, very safe and very protected, privately working with individuals, sometimes with groups, sometimes a bit of teaching that's less protected. But when I'm in a safe, cozy little therapy room, we can all take off our shells, okay? Because that's a safe place to be. But when you're out there and you've got these monkeys from the far left coming out at you and trying to attack you and doing violence. I mean, I remember your description with Dewey about the Posey Parker situation, and you stating very clearly that you thought if she hadn't been protected, she would be dead now, that you actually thought there was murder in those people's minds.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. They would have killed her. I have no doubt about that. I think that they would have felt pretty bad afterwards, but I was looking at their faces. I have seen similar faces when I've seen child pickups or when I've seen footage of things such as the pro-Hamas protests. When I've seen human violence at some of its worst, that's what I saw on their faces. They would have killed her. I have zero doubt about that. That's one of the few things where I'm like, nope, 100%, they would have killed her. I think they would have felt bad afterwards. Actually, I'm not sure if I could even say that, but I believe 100% that they would have killed her if they got her hands on her.
So that's really important, I think, because you're talking now about, and we're touching on two very important things. One is your makeup. And I wonder what elements of your childhood you think has helped make you this particular. Because sometimes the bad stuff in childhood helps us quite a lot in later life. That I spent a lot of time working with people who were really badly damaged in childhood. And you've worked with some very damaged people, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. And in the process of their kind of healing, they turn around often at the end and say, do you know what? I know it was terrible what I went through. This is what some of my clients say at the end. And they say, but if I hadn't gone through that, I wouldn't be who I am now. And I'm really proud of who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no, so fair, very fair.
I'm wondering what kind of elements of your own background and what was it like growing up for you? What did you have to navigate when you were growing up and growing into a man?
So, yeah, that's a good question. I've been through a couple of broken homes. So when we grow up, my mum and my dad, they split when they were five. Dad took us to Auckland, and we grew up in Auckland amongst our extended family and also with Dad.
So where were you before then? Where were you before Auckland?
So I was born in Palmerston North. Then my mum and dad, so mum was a teen mum and dad was a, you know, handsome young guitarist who you know, mum hooked up with. Mum also at the time, we didn't know this at the time, but this came out 30 years later, but mum had been running from a sexual assault from her, from one of her family's boyfriends. So she was very black sheep. No one believed her, so she did a runner. That's where she met up with dad. Then they got hooked up. I came out. And my brother then came out after that. This was in Kawerau for a little bit. So we were Palmerston to Fielding to Kawerau. Then we went over to Australia. Now around then, I think that's where they split. And at that point, we came back to Auckland where the home base was, the Ikile home base was. And we stayed in Mount Wellington growing up. Dad had to work a great deal of the time. We were working class. There's no one else there. So we were looked after by different members of the extended family. But also we had a lot of time, my brother and I, where we were living quite independent. So there'd be nights and days where Dad would be off working until 12, 1, 2 a.m. in the morning, and then we'd be sort of left alone to our devices. That's definitely something that led to how I sort of am now, which is I struggle to be dependent on other people. It's a positive and a negative. So that went on for years. In fact, we also grew up around junkyards and going to dad to the panels beat or to building of electronic panels and such like that. We used to be walking around the junkyards, friendship with the dogs and stuff like that. And there's great adventures, I'll be honest, but it led to a strong independent streak, perhaps overly so. However, it's interesting what you're saying now, because now I can see that my ability to walk alone in certain periods has led to me being able to walk very much alone when other people do not want to deal with the attacks of the left or the constant saturation by academics. Whereas what I went through has enabled me to keep to the truth and to not be swayed by those attempts to what I would refer to as brainwash or indoctrinate us within. It has allowed for that. Then, of course, I then left Dad and my brother for certain reasons, went over to stay with Mum. Mum then ended up, her husband ended up cheating on her. So I was with Mum for a while there, and we ended up in a broken home situation there as well. So that was in Hamilton. I also got into drugs and such like there. That became quite bad. So I ended up going over to Australia, which didn't improve anything. That ended up getting things worse. I ended up hooking up I didn't become affiliated, but I came friendly with a Vietnamese gang over there. And that went on for some years. And then I came back. When I came back, I ended up coming back to the home base. And then I ended up becoming Christian at that point. So when I was 25, that's when I accepted Jesus into my life. I'd been a Catholic, but this was when I truly became Christian. After that, I spotted some youth who were going through some issues. I was able to spot that from my own experiences. That led on to other things, and eventually that led to jobs, becoming the personal professional coming together, and then I sort of exploded after that. Then that's where I built the study, the understanding, sitting on the gutters and the walkways with people, and you know, having the chats to try to bring them down out of suicidal, heavy suicidal desires at that time, and even the good stuff. I was very happy to help build resilience programs and lead youth leadership events, and you know, bring out a little bit of psychometric assessment, all that sort of fun stuff as well. So I'm grateful for being able to utilize the pain of my past to help out those who are going forward into the future. And it was interesting, but I did a debate with Professor Spoonley at Victoria University a few years ago, and Jordan Williams actually pressed me quite heavily. And he said, you know, okay, well, why are you doing this? And I said the usual. I said, in order to help create a conservative base for all our people, blah, 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 blah. And he kept pushing me until I sort of cracked under the pressure. And I just spat out, I can't save enough. I can't save enough. And that was, again, like what you've actually done, that was a very deep insight that I got on myself by utilizing my own inwards look. And I realized that I serve because I carry a, I'll tell you a story and it might help. About 10 years ago, I pulled a few people out of a car. Afterwards, the car was smashed up. And, you know, this was on State Highway 20, on State Highway 20. And, you know, pulled a few people out. And then a little bit later, the car crashed. I got a Bravery and Heroism Award out of it. Got taken on the shows, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it was, you know, really cool, really lovely. But immediately afterwards, I actually went into quite a deep depression, very deep depression. And through that, it was a very big struggle. But a couple of things came out. One, that I need my wife. My wife is desperately a big part of my ability to be softer and also to not go into some deep, dark places. My wife is everything in that. She's my tether. And so she's everything in that regard. The other one is that I do have a desperate desire just to serve, to help people, to save them. And I know that that can seem like you're just trying to be a savior complex. I think that does exist, and it's not always a good thing because it causes harm. You know, when you are trying to, you know, sacrifice yourself to help others. And it's not just in politics, it's also been in just my regular youth work and things like that. We work, we have supervision, we process, we compartmentalize, we do all the tricks in a trade in order to not take on the trauma of the youth that we work with. But the pebbles do add up. It just adds up. It's just what happens. And so why I do what I do now is because we have to save our people. And the ideological assaults upon our world won't stop. They won't stop, and they'll get worse. And we saw that in COVID. We see that in the climate cultist stuff. We see that in the gender ideological repositioning of our child's innocence. So we have to stand up. We have to, or we lose everything. And so I guess it's as simple, as painful as that.
Thank you so much, Elliot. That is so, I was deeply, deeply moved when you talked about your wife and her significance to you. I found that so, so powerful when you spoke of that side of you that relies on her. And I am pretty sure that there's a lot of blokes listening who could relate to that, because it's often not been very allowed for men to be connected with their soft self. And part of the miracle and the blessing, I think, of the way man and woman are made is that we help each other. We're there for each other. And I got that really strongly. Listen, when you were talking about your childhood and you were talking about wandering around the junkyards. I got this amazing picture. Can I share it with you? I just got this flash of a
picture. Go for it.
I've got this image, and it's probably all about me and got nothing to do with you. But I've got this image of you, a kind of, I don't know, probably around about a 9 or 10 year old boy on an adventure, but on his own, wandering through junkyards, which to many of us might be a little bit scary, but toughening it out and on an adventure, but having to learn to be tough. I just got this image, this flash of you kind of having fun, making something of it. But actually, for a lot of us, that would be really quite scary. Am I getting anything at all here that it might relate
no,
to?
No, no, you're right. It was me and my brother, and we would just do at Mount Wellington. We were behind the quarry, so me and him would scarper off, and we ended up nearly dying a few times because we nearly got drowned in the rocks that were coming off conveyor belts because we snuck through and all of that. And then over in Otahoo and Penrose, we used to play in the junkyards all the time. We ended up befriending a junkyard dog. It's one of our fun little stories. We befriended this vicious mongrel and Dad says, yeah, that dog was not a good dog. But my brother and I, we just befriended this dog, and we were the old story of, you know, some of those stories where you see the two people and the dog trailing after, would go into abandoned buses and ships and aluminium stores and swamp areas where it's all multicolored water and but it's all good. It was really interesting, exciting, and loved it. Just loved it. Yeah.
But you do see, don't you, that for some of us, and me particularly, I'm looking at that and I get the excitement, but man, that sounds scary. I mean, that sounds like a tough adventure. And I think, well, no wonder you can handle the far left, man. If you can tame a scrapyard, vicious Doberman pincher or whatever type of, you can handle the left, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is what most people don't understand. Most people think, oh my gosh, how can you take the fight? No, man, that's fun. That's enjoyable. It's like, no, come. It's all good. It's great fun. Absolutely great fun.
That is so interesting because very often in my work, I find my clients turn to me and they say, how do you do this all day long? How do you listen to people, particularly when they're through the worst and they're on their way out and they've found their resilience and they're standing in their boots, you know, they've found who they are and they're feeling stronger. You know, they're not perfect, but they're back together again. And they say, how can you sit and go through all these stories? And they've told me their tough times and they've told me the shit that they don't want anyone else to know. You know, a lot of my clients, if they see me, ex-clients, if they see me walking down the road, they cross to the other side because they know I know stuff about them and they don't want to open the box again. And I tell them that. I say, look, this is going to happen. When you're done with me, I said, this is what's going to happen. You won't want to talk to me. And that's fine. That's good with me because, you know, I'll be the place where all that bad stuff got to be, as it were, expunged or... There's a few X words, including exorcism, actually. I feel that psychotherapy is a kind of gentle kind of exorcism where we go into the wounded places and we close those up. So there's no likelihood of darkness entering those places anymore. So there's a kind of a very non-biblical way of looking at exorcism, if you like. But what interests me is I say to these people that it's just normal for me. And I say, if you'd have grown up in my family, you'd understand. This is normal. This is just normal. I grew up, you know, my family, wonderful family. I love my family, but, you know, man, they were bonkers. It's like they were crazy. And so for me, it's home. It's home, you know, and these are the waters I can swim in every day. I said, plus, you have to understand, I get the incredible fulfillment of watching people put themselves together again and walk free of their past. That's what it's all about. It's not about endless years of therapy. It's about helping people to, you know, walk free. And they might need a crutch here and a crutch here. That's okay. You can get out and you can get through life with that. That's all right. I don't like to do long, long, long-term work. But it's the same thing as what you're describing, which is hey, for you, it's fun.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's all good. That's all good. Well, look, do you know, I've just so enjoyed this conversation. I'm not sure if I want to do any more. What? I feel like we've covered such a lovely area of stuff. How do you feel about this conversation?
Yeah, you're good. You're good. I must have been, because I've had teams where I've had Clint Sykes on, and you know, I've had, you know, geez, they're all bonkers as well. I have to say, I like your style. Actually, I like your style. Your style might be because you've led to me doing inwards looking from an angle, and it's been quite excellent. Actually, it helped me sort of process. I've never said that stuff about my wife, even though I know it, I believe it. But the other stuff there, you know, the old third person. I mean, I've done that before, but I don't know. Somehow you were able to have me do an inwards look, but a lot deeper than I usually do. So that was nice.
Well, I just love to see how, you know, the way your life has been. There is one area I'd love to know about, but it's not really as a psychologist. It's as a fellow Christian, actually, because I'd love to hear how things turned around for you at 25 when you met your pastor. Mm. And I don't know whether you are okay sharing that story on the radio.
No, but if fine.
I personally would love to hear that, because I think these are really important moments. And I don't know what you think, but I am seeing more and more and more people who used to sit on the fence turning to Christ. I don't know if you're finding that, but I am seeing this all around me.
Russell Brand, Rodney Hyde, these are people who I never would have thought would come to the Lord.
Has Russell Brand become a Christian?
Yeah, he just got baptized. He just got baptized last weekend.
Well, do you know what? I got baptized in November. This last November.
Wow.
I'd been a Christian inside, and I had many, many connections, and I kind of never had any doubt about Jesus as my Lord, but it came to the point, and this is what I mean, I suddenly realized that I had to be real about this. And for me, the beauty of the baptism was it was a public act and a declaration which really changed things for me. It means I wasn't being secretive or embarrassed. Now I don't mind saying it. You know, if people don't like to hear that this is my belief, that's fine. But you need to ask yourself, why wouldn't you be interested in someone else's belief? I'm interested in everyone else's belief, so they can be interested in mine, right?
Yeah. No. Well, and I feel not sorry for them, but I know it's probably more difficult for those who are PKs or those who've risen up in Christianity, you know, because they don't have that much of an idea of what they've been saved from. Whereas those of us who became there later, we know what we're saved from. And we also have a practice understanding that we have, in a sense, chosen to become Christianity rather than this is the expectation. You're born into this family, you're Christian. So, okay, cool. Whereas I was for a period, I was atheistic. I was as atheist and then was agnostic for the rest.
And you were a bad boy. I mean, I don't mean that in any bad way, but you were a bad boy. You were in gangs, you know, over in Australia, and you were doing drugs and stuff, and you were not your kind of choir boy with a little halo around your head, were you?
No choir there. In fact, and this also comes from when I was probably raised and how I deal with things, I still carry this feeling that when someone makes me just a little bit angry or something comes across my way, my immediate thought is violence. It's my immediate reactive thought, you know, going back to, you know, obviously before the neurological pathways sort of stiffened up. So I have that, but my foundational, now my fundamental belief in God has allowed me to, that immediate thought goes through a whole bunch of processes and comes out the other end with a thumbs up. No worries. God loves me, God loves you, and you know, I'll do what I got to do, but I don't want to hurt or hit anyone ever again. How did I get saved? So I was Catholic for 12 years, but I did the old hooking up with chicks all over the place, drugs, alcohol, all that stuff, and then I could just do the Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee, blessed art thou among women, blessed with women, blah, 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 blah. Now, that's not to say that Catholicism is wrong. It's not. I think that there it can go a bit weird on stage, but that's a theological argument. For myself, I was the man who led me to the Lord was a Malaysian guy by the name of Victor Lee, a very prominent accountant, oddly enough, in East Auckland. And I got to know him, his family. He brought me to his church, which is a Singaporean church. And the pastor there was saying something. He said along the lines of that he himself used to be addicted to drugs, and he was involved in some of the more nastier elements of the Singapore fast lane, which is actually quite difficult because they tend to kill you if you hold on to more than a 50 bag of weed. So that was it. Just at that point in my life, for whatever reason, I just decided to open my heart a little bit to this the Lord Jesus, who I knew of. I knew who he was, but I didn't really give him much thought. I opened my heart up, and then the whole thing just flooded in. And at that point, it was a beautiful little honeymoon period of maybe about a year or so. Then after that, it was finding ways to help people. It just things seem to be put in my path now, and I don't get too spooky spiritual on it. I don't know, it could be, but I don't necessarily say that it was a God divine thing where so many things popped up in the path where I was able to help and assist in those areas. But that's just what happened. You know, I stepped forward into different areas and it just built up. And there were ups, there were downs, and there were sideways things in my journey. But ever since making that promise, that declaration to open my heart to Jesus, everything sort of flooded through. I was what most people regard as a touch from the Holy Spirit. I got that in October the 30th of 2002, I think it was, which was a very strange sensation, but a powerful one, and one which I've still not been able to identify, and therefore I'm happy to accept the reasonable area of it being a divine touch. And there's been a lot of things that have happened since that have led me to apply the theological position of spiritual elements, biblical spiritual elements, to what has happened to other parts of my life. So I do love Christianity. I love arguing it. I've told churches before that I should not be the one who's in public arguing and defending Christianity, because that's what I ended up doing on TV1, some of the TV1 interviews and things like that nature. But I've said I shouldn't be, because I swear sometimes, I still drink up sometimes, I love to have a cigar once every couple of months or so. So, you know, I'm not that type of, wah! You know, no white shirt halo going on here.
The holy choir boy.
The holy choir boy. But I love the fact that the inside of my bowl is at least cleaner than the outside. And I desperately desire, every time I do something stupid, I'm, you know, so that whole idea of repentance being that even when we do something wrong, it is something which is against, we know it's against it, and we don't want to do it. And it's just, we know that we've done wrong and we're broken for it. So I do. I love it. I love Christianity. And I love the fact that Western culture, which is that combination of Christianity and democracy, has been the greatest on the earth in terms of saving lives, equipping and building people up for the betterment, giving charity out there, being highly scientific advancements, and everything that is of goodness. Not perfect, because we're not perfect, but a lot better than any other system in existence.
So that's an amazing story of a Singaporean church. That was in New Zealand, right? That was in Auckland, right?
Jack Dickey Centre in Green Lane.
Right. Well, what really interests me is you have described yourself being in some quite, I called you a bad boy earlier, didn't I? But what got you out of that? How did you step up? Because I know the work you have done has really helped people get out of that. And I'm wondering what helped you get out of that.
No, it was faith. It was faith. It was God. As a Christian, I would say that the Holy Spirit assisted me in being able to have a much healthier view of life, and also a determined view in terms of pulling myself out of my drugs as well as just the sex and the being a very negative person. And it did help me to view the world in a light that is eternal, an eternal light that allowed it, that even if the darkness is around, still being able to see the light guide my steps into a better way. It did help to have a mentor, someone who discipled me as well. But I think if I look back then, I think about the times where I read the Bible about three times in the first year of being saved or being a Christian. And I remember clearly having my Bible out at Japanese places. This is when we could still smoke ciggies in the restaurant. So I'd have Bible, I'd have my sake, I would always get sake, and then I'd have an ashtray. And all I'd do is sit there and read the word, just constantly, just read the word, smoke, drink my sake. And I'd do that. I just did that for the first year, just read that Bible about three times in a row. And I think the understanding that I got from it, the lessons, the stories, the desire, the God's heart for his people. And I think the fact that most of the characters, the heroes in the Bibles, they all sucked. They were all fractured and flawed human beings. They all sucked, you know. And that, I think, allowed me as someone who also sucks a bit, who's a cracked jar of clay, to say, oh, okay, well, the Bible's not these people in white shirts going, whoa. Actually, man, so many the Bible heroes, they sucked. But the thing was, they knew they sucked. And they came to points in their life where they threw themselves on God's mercy and said, yeah, man, I suck. I suck hard. And it's that beautiful vulnerability that then allowed God to use them at that point. And so I suppose I've carried it, and I guess it's been for a couple of decades, but I've been that person. I'm cracked, I'm broken, I suck, but it is the Lord who has helped other people through me. And I don't discount my own self in that. I'm proud to have carried his name, and also embarrassed that I have cast dishonor on his name every now and then. But I'm happy to be lovingly in his arms, and when that day comes that I leave this earth in whatever manner, then I will be able to go to him and be in that eternal place as well, resting. Which is why I still have that not sinful, but I know that at some point it may come a time where I have to give my life for the cause, and I don't want to, but if that's the cost, then so be it.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's a very powerful, I mean, that image of you drinking sake and just literally eating the Bible up, it's just so, I just imagine sort of passing you by in this. Where did you do this? Where were you?
Mostly in Japanese shops around the CBD area. And it was a massive Bible.
I can just imagine walking past you and seeing this guy. That's you, seeing this guy, you know, and just sort of, and sometimes I walk down, because I live in Wanaka, and sometimes I walk down by the lake. And, you know, very often I see people sitting there, and sometimes they're reading novels and sometimes they're writing journals. It's actually quite a meditative place. I mean, sometimes it's very busy and fun-based, and, you know, the hot summer months, there's boats and noisy buggers all around. But quite a lot of the time, people just go down there and they sit quietly and they wrap themselves, even in the winter, they wrap themselves up. And very often you see people just reading their Bible quietly by the lake. It's a powerful place, that lake. It's a place of great healing, I believe. And so, you know, the picture of you smoking your fags, drinking your sake in a Japanese cafe, devouring the Bible, will stay with me, Elliot. That's a beautiful image. I absolutely love it.
Oh, good times, good times.
But I've just so enjoyed talking with you, and I probably should have said at several moments during this, you can tell how interested I got. I forgot to say that you're listening to real people in the psychotherapist chair with me, Jerry Pives, and this is Elliot Ukulele. And we've been talking about all sorts of really fascinating stuff, and it's been a real privilege and a pleasure to meet you. Mm-hmm. I've never met you before, and I just want to say what a real honor it is to have met you. And God bless you for all your work and all that you do, and the strength. We need strong men more than any time in our history, and you are a beautiful, strong man. Thank you so much, Elliot Ukulele.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you so much. My pleasure all.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.